From the Sky News Centre, a teenager who idolised the Yorkshire Ripper and killed two strangers in Essex has been sentenced to at least 27 years behind bars. James Fairweather was just 15 when he attacked James Atfield and Nahid Almanea in Colchester. They were both stabbed to death in random attacks. Assistant Chief Constable Steve Warren has given his reaction at the Old Bailey.
The brutal and sadistic nature of the killings had a massive impact upon the local community, striking fear into residents for a period of 14 months until James Fairweather was arrested and charged.
A British passenger has been killed after a helicopter crashed off the coast of Norway. Rescue workers say there are no signs of survivors and the Super Puma model involved has been grounded by Norwegian authorities. Two men from Birmingham have appeared in court charged with giving money to the suspected bomb maker behind the attacks in Brussels and Paris. The pair are accused of meeting Mohamed Abrini in a park last summer. It's claimed Britain's ability to tackle humanitarian crises across the world would be diminished if we vote to leave the European Union. Justine Greening says the United Kingdom would not have been able to play the leading role it did in supporting refugees had it been outside the EU. Prince Harry has enlisted the Queen for some fighting talk ahead of the Invictus Games. His Paralympic-style competition is due to take place in Orlando, Florida next month. In a video posted on the Kensington Palace Twitter account, Harry shows his grandmother a video in which President Obama and his wife Michelle respond to his challenge.
Would you like to watch it together?
Yes.
Let's have a look.
Prince Harry, remember when you told us to bring it at the Invictus Games?
Careful what you wish for.
Boom.
Oh, really? Please.
Boom.
That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling. And in the run-up to next Thursday's elections, we have a studio with City Council party leaders. After the 6 o'clock news, Martin Summers is here for a good look around the world, and we'll be asking if, with articles in popular magazines this week in the United States, America is finally waking up to the role of the Saudi royal family and the Saudi government in the 9/11 attacks. That same Saudi government that Britain is making a fortune out of selling arms and munitions they're using against Yemen. Well, even before last year's bombardment started, that was the poorest country in the Middle East. Then we have a look at Brazil. In the run-up to this year's Olympic Games, we're seeing the Brazilian establishment, largely private media over there, rounding on President Dilma Rousseff, sending the country back to the bad old days of US colonialism and interference in Latin American politics, perhaps? Then there's the latest instalment in our revisiting of the World War II Battle of Arnhem. The film A Bridge Too Far portrays Robert Redford on the bridge at Nijmegen, demanding to know why the British tanks have stopped when a quick charge down the road could win the battle. This week, we hear how Dutch resistance fighter Christian Lindemans was a suspected German agent, but he was sent in anyway to betray the battle plan 2 days before the Allied paratroopers dropped in the biggest airborne operation in history. So, on to the party leaders in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3, pretty chilly and frosty. This weekend, highs of 11, sunshine and showers on Saturday, wet and windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, wet and windy on Monday, sunshine and some showers for the rest of the week. Next weekend, that's the 7th and 8th of May, highs of 16, wet and windy again. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So next Thursday we'll be voting for two councillors in each of 34 wards, many of them with new boundaries. That's one less ward than before, and it means that next week the city will have 68 councillors, two less than now. Now, I better check with everyone in the studio. Have I got that right?
No.
No.
Oh, dear. Okay. Helen, would you want to correct me then, please?
Okay.
Maybe I just miscounted. It's quite a lot to count.
There's still going to be 70 councillors.
There's going to be 34 wards, that bit's right, but there's a mixture of 1, 2 and 3 member wards, which we've never had before, and that's what the Local Government Boundary Commission gave us.
OK, well, that's how I managed to get confused on that. Sorry, folks. Anyway, so as well as all the parties represented here, you may be able to vote for candidates from the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition, that's TUSC. Also, something called the Wessex Regionalists, I've not come across before. And also independent candidates too are standing in some of the wards next Thursday. We're joined by from the Labour Party, Helen Holland, from the Greens, Annie Stafford Townsend, and also Alastair Watson, who replaces Mark Weston from the Conservative Party. But look, let's start with a question for all of you. Maybe you first, Alastair. Bristol's annual anarchist book fair takes place at the Trinity Centre tomorrow. Do you have any sympathy with the anarchist view that politics is a stitch-up against the public?
Well, no. I think that's an easy one to argue against. I'm not an anarchist. I don't have any sympathy for them. What can I say? I think, have any anarchists ever been voted into? I suppose they wouldn't be, would they? Because they're anarchists, but... No, it's a bit of a silly question, Tony.
Was it Churchill who said that parliamentary democracy was a terrible system, but it was the best one we'd got? So, we've got the democracy.
But the thing is, there's
people need to participate. That's the important thing.
I'm not going to let Alistair get totally off the hook here, because for a lot of people, particularly at the poorer end of society, they're looking at politics as basically a mechanism by which wealth has been taken away from the poor, the services have been taken away from the poor since the Second World War, since after the war, really, and given to the rich. And we're now in this situation with the Panama Papers, tax havens, that sort of thing, where the rich are able to squirrel away their money without it being taxed, and the tax burden is increasingly falling on the poorer half of society.
I'm not sure that's true, actually. I don't know where you get your information from. I think that people who are wealthy are paying a lot of taxes, obviously, and particularly for this government, the Conservative government, they take an awful lot of people out of tax at the bottom end. I think that's quite a wrong assertion, actually.
Even with things like utility bills, Alistair, if you invest something like £10,000 in shares in one of the utility companies, you really never have to pay utility bills again, because the dividends will pay your bills for you. So it just seems there's one law for the rich and obviously coin meters for the poor.
Well, that's a risk one takes with it. Your £10,000, isn't it? You could put it in a building society. At the moment, interest rates are low, but maybe returns are a little bit more on some equities. But I've got a few shares, not many, I hasten to add, but they're not doing very well at the moment, so I can't pay my utility bills with those.
But isn't the role of government and local government too to try and make sure that the resources which we take in tax are given to those that most need them?
Yes, but there's also other things that tax is used for. We have to look after our security. We've got the NHS to provide for. We've got education, we're not here to redistribute money from rich to poor. We're here to make sure that everybody has opportunities in life.
Okay, I'll ask you the same question, Helen Holland, about the anarchists. I'll remind everybody that it's the annual book fair at the Trinity Centre tomorrow. Do you have sympathy with the anarchist view that politics is a stitch-up against the people?
Well, I think politics is a stitch-up if people don't participate. That's the important thing, and next Thursday. These are big elections with big budgets that are under control by the Police and Crime Commissioner, the whole of the policing budget for the whole of Avon and Somerset, the Mayor obviously in charge of the whole of the Bristol budget, and the 70 councillors. So what we're saying to people on the doorstep now is, those people who say to you, I don't bother, I sometimes, when I'm brave enough, say to them, well, that doesn't give you the right to complain afterwards about what happens. You have to take the chance when you have it to participate in choosing who's going to represent you.
And what about you, Annie Stafford Townsend, from the Green Party? Will you be going to the Anarchist Book Fair, and do you have sympathy for this idea that politics is actually working against the interests of the public?
I do have sympathy. I probably won't get to the book fair because I'll be on the doorstep. But I do have sympathy with that point of view. And the problem is, whilst I have sympathy with it, if you allow that to sort of override your desire to then actually get involved with the democratic process, even though it's flawed and there's a lot of issues with it, then actually those people that you're against as an anarchist are winning, because the only option and the only route you have for change is by using your vote. And therefore, and particularly right now, this is a very crucial election, as Helen says.
Now, if you're looking for people to persuade to go and vote who might not otherwise, surely the book fair is the place to be.
Some of our members will be there, don't you worry, probably behind the stalls as well as in front of them.
What about that? You're wincing there, Alistair. Can I persuade you to go down to the book fair to persuade people to vote?
You're completely obsessed with this book fair. I've got absolutely no idea where you're coming from this, Tony. Can't we talk about proper issues that people in Bristol will be voting
on? I mean,
there's hardly anybody going to go to an anarchist book fair.
There are actually quite a lot of people do go, and a lot of issues do get discussed there, the sort of things we talk about here in a much more open forum. So anyway, that's taking place tomorrow at the Trinity Centre if anyone's interested, and maybe I better stop talking about it now before Alistair criticises me anymore. So anyway, let's talk about something which we do know large amounts of our money is being spent on. That's the arena. That's about to start, it looks like, but it could mean the council's saddled with unpayable debts for the next decade or more, especially if interest rates go up. Alistair, back to you. Can you not think of a better way to spend £93 million of our money?
I think it's a good way to spend some money. I think it will help to regenerate that area of Bristol, and I think it'll be very positive for the whole of Bristol. I think we are missing out on a large venue for concerts and exhibitions. So I think it'll be a very useful addition to what we have in Bristol. And to be honest, I mean, I was involved in scrutiny of the business plans, and I think they're pretty robust. I was worried that we'd end up with a white elephant and we'd be paying for it over many decades, but I think we won't be, and the money is there through the local enterprise partnership. It's not like council tax money, but true, you know, we could be saddled with something if things go desperately wrong.
How long is it going to take for us to pay off the debt?
I don't know. I haven't got those figures with me, Tony.
Okay, Helen. What about you on the arena side? Are you one of the people who's persuaded this is a good way to spend that money, and you can't think of anywhere better to spend it?
Well, people can always think of better ways to spend money, but the fact is, I mean, as Alistair says, this isn't as if this is a pot of money which we've got the choice of spending on lots of other things. This is money that specifically comes through the local enterprise partnership for this project, and I think Labour councillors have been very supportive of the arena. In fact, it was us way back that were the first ones who looked for a site for an arena, and that site, even way back then in the early 2000s, was the preferred one because of all the synergy, hopefully, of getting the transport right, because it's right next to the station. But I think our view has been that for the investment that the city is going to make in it, there's some bottom lines, and that's around, if my colleague Estella Tinkner was here, the deputy leader, she's been very clear that the jobs that we talk about in the arena aren't just the ones cleaning it and making the sandwiches for it, that we need people from the local area in particular to get apprenticeships there. We want local people to benefit from the construction phase of it, and then once it's open, and hopefully the great success that it's going to be, that some local people are working there and bringing that economic benefit into their communities.
How long until the debt, money we're borrowing to build this arena, is going to be paid off then?
Like Alistair, I'm not aware of those figures, but I wasn't sitting on the committee that had a good look at those figures.
But that's basic stuff, isn't it? I mean, we don't want to be saddled with this debt for a long time in the future. I'll ask the same to you, Annie. Do you know how long it's going to take to pay off the arena? It's a lot of money, isn't it? It's public money. It's not all coming from the council. It's also, as we've heard, coming from the local enterprise partnership. But it'd be nice to know that it's on a sound financial footing, even if interest rates go up, because they certainly can't go down.
Mm-hmm. I also wasn't on the committee or the scrutiny committee for it, so I've not looked at the figures in detail. And as the other two have said, the way in which a lot of the funding for various projects and elements of the council's responsibilities come is that they're ring fenced. So you, even though ideally we'd love to spend it on building 10 million houses, we can't because it's ring fenced for something else. So it does seem to be something that a lot of Bristolians want. It's very important that we get it right, and we will as a council be making sure that we do scrutinise it to make sure the money is spent correctly and the transport plan doesn't have a detrimental effect on the local community as well.
Yeah, well, that does seem to be one of the big hiccups. Maybe it's gotten over now, the transport side of the arena. I don't want to be a party pooper on this. It'd be lovely to have an arena. It's just, I mean, a lot of the money is coming through the local enterprise partnership, quite clearly. Maybe I'll start with you, Annie, because this is, I mean, I've tried over the last several months to find out a bit more about this local enterprise partnership. It doesn't seem to be elected. It's not elected. It covers the region, it seems, more than just Bristol, and many of the people are sort of, I suppose, what you call big business, sometimes on the verge of public and private sector, who actually sit on it. And their press officer, Julia Dean, wouldn't tell me what the budget they spend was. She said, she kept saying, well, it's only a few thousand pounds administration for meetings that we hold. But actually, the local enterprise partnership is a bit more than that, isn't it? It spends quite a lot of taxpayers' money. And in fact, well, it doesn't actually spend it. It recommends where government should put that money. So it's got a lot of power, millions of our taxpayers' money. Tell us what you know and what you think about this local enterprise partnership, Annie.
I actually don't know a huge amount about the ins and outs of it. Have you tried to FOI any other questions that you're asking?
No, I haven't.
Asking?
No, no. But that's a good idea. Yeah, I should do that. But what about you, Helen? Who are these
people? Well, local... I mean, I'm not absolutely certain who's on the board at the moment. I knew the original ones. And local enterprise partnership, it's one of those things, isn't it? And I think you're going to want to come on to talk about the Metro Mayor later. But that government set up local enterprise partnerships and their aim was to represent business. And so the majority of the places are for business people and it's chaired by business, but the four local authorities sit on it. So our mayor sits on it and the leaders of the other three sit on it. And my understanding is that even though there are more business people than the four local authority people, the local authority people do have the veto. So the local enterprise partnership can't press something that the leader of that particular council doesn't want in their area. So it's one of those things where that's the way that money is devolved by government. So if the West of England, because it is the West of England, not just Bristol in this case, wants to get hold of that infrastructure money, that's the game you have to play. And I think the important thing is that those bodies do have to be accountable, and there does have to be a mechanism where councillors, especially as your, you know, residents elected reps, are able to see what's going on and to be able to ask questions. So, you know, looking at the West of England website would be a start, because all the papers for the LEP, as I understand it, are all on there.
Yeah, they certainly are. It's quite a lot of information, but it doesn't say how much money they spend altogether. It's certainly something for it's called the West of England LEP.co.uk. What bothers me is that this isn't really democratic at all. It's business appointing people to spend public money. And the other side of it, maybe I can move to you, Alistair, now, is that the public aren't allowed to come along to the meetings, are they? So there'll be discussions going on.
The meetings are open.
I thought the meetings were open, but I do sit on one of the committees of the LEP, actually. I sit on the high-tech sector group, and I'm involved quite a bit with that part of the LEP. I think the thing
is, do you actually have members of the public coming along?
They don't come along to our meetings, the group meetings, no, the sector group meetings. We quite enjoy people coming to speak to us and be involved in the meetings, but we don't hold those in open session. But I think the actual board itself would have some open meetings. I'm really not absolutely sure. I mean, the LEP was put in to replace the Regional Development Council.
Regional Development Agency. That's right. Yeah.
The Swerda Southwest, and it is to give a voice to Bristol, to enterprise and business in the region. As you say, it's the four unitary councils, and it doesn't have its own bank account. It doesn't have money. It uses Bath and North East Somerset as they have the money that pays for its administration costs and so on. So it's really more of an advisory body rather than as a channel for huge amounts of government funding.
I mean, just looking at the website, as you suggested, the board here, it doesn't actually tell you when the next meeting is taking place. Obviously, it's not going to be that easy to, as a member of the public or press, to go along to it. But anyway, I just thought it'd be useful to clear that up, because I know the Local Enterprise Partnership also played a part in Metrobus, which I want to talk about now. That there's quite a lot of money being spent on that, Alistair. Is this going to be money well spent? And are we going to end up thinking this is a great project for the city?
It's the only project in town as far as improving our infrastructure is concerned, which is a shame because it is a flawed project. I think none of us would really want this as our sort of flagship how to get transport moving in Bristol. We'd all like to see something a bit better, but it came to the point where this was the only money that was available. If we didn't do it, we wouldn't be able to put the money elsewhere. It's a bit of a sort of, you know, a compromise situation. I think when it's built, and it, you know, it will connect up, particularly some areas of South Bristol will be able to get in and out of the city centre a bit better. So I think at the moment it's absolutely atrocious because you can't get anywhere on a bus or a car or anything else at the moment. But when it's built, hopefully you know, it will be able to move lots of people. I think it's a compromise, but it's better than nothing.
Helen, I mean, I'm not the only person that's saying this, but I mean, people are wondering, is the congestion that's being caused for the year or so we're going to have to put up with all these roadworks, is that actually far more than the congestion it's going to save once it's built, this metro bus?
Well, I think if you look at anywhere, I mean, it's very easy, isn't it, when you go to somewhere that's got a fully built and functioning metro system and you think, gosh, this is wonderful. If you weren't there when it was being built and you don't know what the chaos was like, I mean, Nottingham is my hometown. When I go back to see my mum, they're building another line of the tram now, and I can tell you that the congestion around where they're building it, you sort of think, gosh, is this worth it? But then I also see the places where the lines are, and they are fantastic. Whether we're going to get the step change, I agree with Alistair that, you know, this doesn't feel as if it's the big 21st century solution that the tram was going to have been if we could have delivered that. But again, you know, government priorities changed. They weren't funding trams any longer because of the cost overruns in all of the ones that they had funded, and so this, as Alistair says, was the best option. But I do really, really hope that it is that step change, so that more people, it isn't just going to be a better service for people who already use public transport, it will attract lots more people.
But we've already
out
heard,
of their cars.
I mean, you talked about cost overruns there, but we've already heard that the frequency of it is going to be less than they originally thought. I think, is it down to 3 an hour or 2 an hour rather than
I don't think it's that few, but
maybe 3 rather than 2. Anyway, Annie.
Yeah, I think it is going to be 3 quite often. It's not going to be good enough for what we need. And as I represent Cabot Ward, which has obviously got the majority of the roadworks going through the centre of it, and has been an absolute nightmare and headache for the entire year so far. Whether or not it will be worth the chaos and the environmental disruption, I'm thinking of things like Blue Finger allotments in Stapleton specifically, time will tell. Hopefully we can work cross-party to put pressure on and make sure that we do actually have enough buses coming down it to make it worthwhile.
I wonder if any of you have been over to Cambridge, because I got one of these over in Cambridge, and I'm looking at some of the news stories to do with it, horrendous accidents and things happening, delays, people deciding that I'm going to use my car instead of trying to use this thing, because it's a halfway house between a bus and a tram, isn't it? It's sort of a bus that just drives along the road and then sits itself into a tram line. Anyway, I suppose only time will tell on that one. Let's move on to as Helen mentioned a little bit earlier about the Metro Mayor, and maybe you could just kick off, Helen. Explain to us, what is this Metro Mayor and is it going to be good for the city? That's Helen from the Labour Party.
Well, again, this is one of those things that government talks a good talk about devolving to local authorities, but then they put a preferred model in place, and basically it's take it or leave it, because if you want those additional powers, if you want the powers over regulating buses, if you want to be able to be involved in local train franchising, this is the model that you have to accept. And if you look at the places that are being talked up in a big way, like, you know, Greater Manchester, about the powers that they've got, they've had to accept that there will be a Metro Mayor for Greater Manchester sitting above, I think it's 10 local authorities that make up the Greater Manchester.
And I think I'm right in saying the Manchester Mayor was appointed. No one ever elected him. And it's
The first one is appointed, but it will be elected from next year, from 2017. And so...
So that's bonkers, isn't it? Surely, I mean, how can you have a mayor that someone's just said, oh, right, you can be mayor for a few years until we have an election?
That was the model that the 10 councils wanted. So they didn't want to have an election in the first place. They wanted to have an appointment. And I think it's the person who's the current Police and Crime Commissioner for Greater Manchester who's been appointed as the Metro Mayor until they have the election in 2017. So... in terms of the West of England, which is what they call Bristol and our three neighbours, South Gloucestershire, Bath and North East Somerset and North Somerset, so they put a bid in, which was agreed by all of the four leaders, our mayor and the three leaders, to ask for more powers for the West of England area. And you might remember it was on the budget day that George Osborne announced that he was looking favourably at ours, and I think it was only one other that he announced that day. I can't remember, because lots of places have put bids in. Some of them are now falling apart as they work through the details, but ours is still up there in the eye of the ministers. And so we've got to decide whether or not this is something that we want and whether we do want those powers. But the price of having those extra powers and the extra money, which is £1 billion up to 20 something, can't quite remember how long that, I think, yeah, it might like, be over 10 years.
Yes, something like that, yeah.
But the price of having that would be that there would have to be a Metro Mayor for the West of England. And so that's something that we do need to hear from residents about, whether they think that that's a price worth paying.
I mean, isn't there something fundamentally wrong with that, saying, well, look, we'll let you have this money, but only if you have this new system?
There is something fundamentally wrong with it, but I'm afraid, you know, the government was elected last year. This is the model that they have decided. And if we want those powers, which is something, you know, when I had the transport brief all those years ago, one of my great frustrations was not being able to have the same powers as the London mayor had, for example. So there's different legislation in London. To be able to have that in Bristol and be able to control our own affairs, this is the price that has to be paid.
Okay.
Or you can be a place that decides, actually, we're not going to do it. And some places have now backed out of their emerging deals because of that.
So how is it actually going to work then? Is it going to be one mayor over? Because you're going to have a mayor for Bristol, then you're going to have a Metro Mayor as two separate people. How are they going to make
exactly,
decisions?
And
are they going to have their own cabinet, the Metro Mayor?
No.
People from other parts of the... No?
No. In effect, the Metro Mayor would be like having the chair of the cabinet of mayors and leaders of the involved councils. So we hope it will be all four, because that's the economic area, isn't it, for the West of England, is North Somerset, Bath and North East Somerset, South Gloucestershire and ourselves. But, you know, if you look at Greater Manchester, we've already talked about, they've now got a Metro Mayor, they've got the leaders of all of the other councils. One of them, Salford, is a mayoral authority, so you've got a mayor of Salford with a Metro Mayor of Greater Manchester above them. So it isn't you know, it sounds confusing now because we haven't had that system, but I'm sure that people, if they're willing to and want those powers, they can make it work.
And do you think it will happen here?
Well, my understanding is that each of the four councils has got to approve it, and that's scheduled for meetings at the end of June. Well, we haven't got a council in place. Well, we've got ourselves currently for the next 6 days, but we don't know who's going to be sitting there after next Thursday. So and my guess is that there will be quite a lot of new councillors on all of the parties, because there are some people standing down, some people retiring, some seats will change hands. So it's going to be a very, very steep learning curve for those councillors to vote on this, because it's quite a difficult concept to think about how this would work. And it's a big decision that's going to come to the council at the end of June. Personally, if I'm there, if I'm re-elected next Thursday, I will be voting for it, because I think it would be a travesty to turn down that investment that Bristol so desperately needs in its infrastructure.
Alistair, Metro Mayor, good thing or bad thing?
I'm very enthusiastic about having a Metro Mayor. I think it makes sense on a quite a number of levels. I do agree that the government is, in a way, bribing us to move in this direction. I think it's a direction that we should be going in anyway. I think if the people in Filton or, you know, various other sort of areas, even Stoke Gifford and Bradley Stoke, they'd say they lived in Bristol. You know, if they weren't in, you know, their houses at the time, you know, and they're talking to people. Bristol is the wider Bristol. It's the greater Bristol area. And you know, when we're looking at infrastructure, roads, railways, park and rides, that, you know, that it encompasses that region. And a Metro Mayor would then be able to take that overview. Now, I know the West of England Partnership, and To give them their due, the West of England Partnership is now working reasonably well, I have to say, between all the councils, better than it has done in the past. But a Metro Mayor gives it a focus. It's a bit like, you know, George has given everybody a focus for Bristol. You know who's running the city, and it, you know, I think it would be a good thing in quite a number of ways.
Also, your what's the programme? Would it be, if we say yes to this later in the summer, will there be an election, or will we get one of these Manchester style appointed Metro Mayor?
I think at the moment the smart money's on having an election in November for our first Metro Mayor. I mean, the powers are slightly more limited than Manchester, and again, we've only got four councils here as opposed to the 10 or so up in Manchester, or however many they've got in London. But remember, London's got mayors of various boroughs, and they've got a sort of Metro Mayor for the London city, the greater London city. So we, you know, It happens around the country, and I think it could happen here. I think it would be an interesting development. The Metro Mayor wouldn't have all powers, but would have powers over stuff like planning.
Well, that's a big one, isn't it?
Yeah. And the plan.
Strategic planning.
Strategic planning.
I mean, people. Each council would still do its own. Yeah. Planning applications. You wouldn't get rid of the local planning authority.
Annie, let's just move on to Annie here. What do you make of this Metro Mayor? Because, I mean, I get the idea that it's being sold to us as a kind of devolution. You're going to get more money, more powers. But actually, it may be a centralisation of power.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more cautious about it for my colleagues. I think there will be definite advantages to it, you know, transport for example being a big one, and an overarching infrastructure planning view will obviously also be good, but we also don't know enough of the finer detail of it at the moment, and that's what makes us hold back from our enthusiasm. The funding, for a start, it's basically our only option, so it's a bit of a it is not a sort of a willing thing. We have, it's the only game in town, essentially. But also, that money isn't freely given. We have to meet a certain economic criteria and targets. So what happens if we don't meet them, for example? Those are details that we don't fully have. And also, in terms of democracy, the local councillors haven't really been consulted and involved in any of this so far. And therefore, how democratic is it really? We don't know the details, let alone do the Bristol people. And by the time we do know the details, it will be essentially too late. So we are very cautionary about it, but there's definite plus sides as well as some serious downsides if we get it wrong.
In common, I think, with certainly some of my colleagues, we've signed a letter to Oliver Letwin, who's the appropriate minister, to ask why it is that the four authorities couldn't have a referendum on the referendum day on June the 23rd, when we're having the European referendum anyway. So we could ask the residents of the four authorities what they think about this. I mean, I agree with Annie that getting the concept over about what people were voting on. But my understanding is that that's been dismissed, which is really unfortunate, because I do agree with Annie that one of the big problems about this, and I've been saying this all along, is it's all very well for the power to kind of come down the M4 to Bristol, but if local people haven't got any more say in what goes on, then it's kind of doesn't make any difference to them whether it's Whitehall or the council house that's making the decisions. So you have to have one of the things that I do think we do need to know a lot more about is the accountability and how it'll be scrutinised and how people will be able to hold it to account if we go that way.
Yeah, because again, if we do have a referendum on it, it can't be like when we had a mayoral referendum when people didn't really know what they were voting on. We didn't know what the powers of the mayor was going to be, even I think at the point we actually voted for George Ferguson or didn't vote for George Ferguson or whichever way people voted. We didn't know what we were voting for at the point that we voted, and that's not a real democratic way of doing it, because the people of Bristol do need to know exactly what they're voting on if we have a referendum, which
quickly, all three of you, first you, Annie, do councillors have any power now? Because this Metro Mayor seems as if the councillors will have almost no power left if you've got various mayors deciding everything.
I think it's a different kind of power. There's very real power in terms of things like licensing and planning, but a lot of our power is a lot more soft and a different kind of powers to how it would have been 4 years ago.
Helen?
Well, I do think that councillors have certainly there are legal powers that we have as elected members.
I suppose I'm talking really about power over how you're spending our money. I mean, that's the, you know.
Yeah, but this isn't money that the city council decides how it's spent at the moment anyway. It's money that the government decides how it's spent. So in that regard, the decisions about how you spend those big chunks of infrastructure money would come that much closer to home.
Alistair, what do you make of the power of councillors these days? Is it diminishing?
It certainly has changed, but I think we have influence. Even with George at his stroppiest, I think that we could still influence some of his decisions. And, you know, he did in the end listen if we spoke long enough and coherently enough. I think that a couple of parties did put him off a bit and he wouldn't listen to the Liberal Democrats after a little while. But, you know, if you use influence properly, you can exercise those powers for the residents that you're representing.
Well, one of the questions that comes up again and again, certainly when I talk to people out there, is housing and whether we've got enough council houses. Obviously, we don't. We've got somewhere over 15,000 people on the waiting list here in Bristol. And one of those is a chap called Anthony Palmer. He's a single dad, ex-forces, who's been squatting in a house in Avonmouth, which is a former council house, which the city council have decided to sell off a couple of weeks ago at an auction, and it looks as if that he will be evicted from there and then it will be handed over to whoever bought it at the auction. So let's have a listen now to Anthony Palmer, a brief clip with him talking about the way that the council's dealt with him when he found himself homeless with a young son.
As I left the army, you know, I was on the reservist list for 5 years. So, you know, up to 2 years ago, I could, you know, if we went to war, I would have been one of the first people to be called up, and I would happily fight for my country. You know, I'm trained to fight for my country. And, you know, but what, you know, it feels I've got to a stage now, why would I want to fight for a country that can't even help me when I've hit a hard place in my life? You know, my son, you, I want to do everything I can for him, but it feels like my hands are tied behind my back and I've just got to put up and shut up. So this is why I've taken, you know, some of the action I've taken, and I'm trying to highlight these problems because they need to be addressed. You know, you can't keep going on ignoring people, putting people, you know, in slums and in property that is not fit for, you know, a family, and cramped conditions. You know, I'm living out of bags, you know, I haven't got space to put my son's clothes anywhere. You know, there's two washing machines per like 30, 40 families. It's like, you know, I get 2 hours a week to do all my washing. You know, it's like, we haven't even got a laundrette, or, you know, this same company, mind, is just making millions off the council a year. They've got land everywhere, land at the back of the building where I'm staying. And it's a rubble site. They can't even put a little grassed area for the kids to play on, you know. It's, you know, and you know, the owner's driving around in a white Lamborghini. Do you know, it's like, and they're charging, you know, more than what, you know, a private person would charge for a flat. Like, you know, it's ridiculous. I don't know how they're getting away with it for so long.
Okay, yes, that was Anthony Palmer. He's a single dad, ex-forces, who is really part of a campaign to try and stop the council, essentially, selling off the council homes. Alistair, are we in a situation now where the council really is starting to roll back its any sort of real ability to help homeless people, because there are quite a lot of people like him out there, and he's got a young son, and he says he's basically housed in dreadful conditions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know his particular personal details. So, I mean, you know, quite often there are other aspects to this when you start to dig into it. But yeah, we haven't got enough houses in Bristol. I think the council has a role to play, a big role to play, in making sure affordable housing for those people who, you know, perhaps are finding it very difficult to find accommodation. But there's obviously people with high end needs and criteria from others, so it's a difficult situation, given that we probably never would have enough to you know, house everybody that would like to be housed.
I can remember chatting to Stella Clark. She was the chair of Knightstone Housing Association a while ago. But before that, she was in public housing, and she said, basically, I finished my job in the late 1970s because we built enough houses for everybody, public housing. Gone down since then, haven't we?
Times have changed. Yeah. And I mean, there was a time in the 70s when Bristol was actually diminishing in population. And we have increased over the last 10 or 20 years, and it's, you know, times in, you know, Bristol have changed over that period, and you can't look back to that. We do need to be providing more accommodation as part of the budget. And you said, can councillors have an influence? Before, the Conservatives actually got a change in the budget where we've had £9 million put in. It's not a lot for housing, but it will start, and it will kick off a fund to be able to get others involved so that we can start to provide more housing. And I think that's what we need to do.
So that's Alistair Watson from the Conservative Party. We're about to hear from Helen Holland from the Labour Party and Annie Stafford Townsend from the Green Party. But before we do that, staying on housing, we've got a clip now from earlier this year at one of the sleepouts at Pip and Jay's, and it's what I thought was quite an interesting you know, but basically people sleeping out for the night to draw attention to the problem in Bristol, where we've now got around about four times the number of people sleeping out on the streets that we had before 2010, with the David Cameron first became Prime Minister. And here is Paul Saville, you can hear, having a chat with George Ferguson, who were both on that sleep out.
Hundreds of thousands of people's lives and their problems with drugs and homelessness and housing crisis, and he wants to get re-elected.
You can have this debate elsewhere. What we're doing here tonight is that this is 200 people working.
Can I just say, I totally agree with what you're saying, and I'd rather pay £4 extra a month for council tax and open the buildings up to homeless people.
That's lovely.
Okay, and I'm born and bred in Bristol. I would rather pay £4 a month extra and open up all the empty buildings.
That's lovely.
That's my personal, and I've heard what's going
lots
on,
of love.
And I just wanted to come and tell you.
Thank you.
My personal opinion, as a householder in Bristol, and I pay for an extortion and rent. And I would rather do that and sacrifice that to open the bowling because I think it's a waste, and I totally agree with what you're saying. I work in Broadmead and I see the suffering every day. I work just next door to Boots, and in the centre there's people on mattresses, and do you know what, those people are decent people, and I have come from nothing and I've had no help. My soul will support any of you guys, and I will give anything, and I would rather pay £4 a month extra council tax to open up those buildings, because I really believe in what you're saying.
Yeah. Can we have the debate? This is a good debate, but it's not what we're here for.
No, it's not what we're here for. But I just heard what these people said, and I just wanted to personally come over and say I think you've got a good point to make.
Well, that wasn't most of the talking wasn't being done by Paul Savile or George Ferguson there at the Pip and Jay Sleepout, but by a lady that works in Broadmead. Helen, this is an increasing problem. It's almost going up exponentially. More and more people are having to sleep on the streets. Is the council getting to the point where it's thinking, well, actually, this isn't really our role anymore to help the homeless?
I think the council does think it's its role to help the homeless. I think what it isn't doing is drawing on the resources of all the other people who are out there doing similar work and coordinating that work. And there is an absolute crisis in Bristol. So it's not just the 14,000 people who are on the council house waiting list. It's the lack of affordable housing and the cost of it. It's the condition of some of the private rented homes. And I think we've all working very closely with an organisation called Acorn that works with people in poor private rented housing. You've got 6,000 units, housing units, so either home houses or flats, with planning permission that haven't been built. And I think one of the things is that we do need to knock down the barriers that are stopping those developers building those houses and say to them, if you're not going to build them, actually, we'll take away that planning permission that you have and work with people who are going to be able to build those units, because they're desperately needed. And the other thing is that both the cost of rental and the cost of housing is the difference between average earnings and those costs are as high here as they are in London and the South East now. So it's a growing problem, and it's not one that the current mayor has done enough about.
Okay, so there's all these developers out there with all this lovely planning permission, which most of us would almost die for. The amount of money you could make by building a place like that is incredible. But it does suggest, doesn't it, that the houses that are already there are not being sold.
No, it doesn't suggest that at all.
The prices are too high, no?
No, it isn't. That's one of the problems about Bristol, is that actually you've got people, coming down who sold property in London and can push up those Bristol prices, because housing is at a premium in Bristol. And so the prices are being pushed up, and that's stopping local people being able to afford to buy the appropriate housing. So if those 6,000 units were all built, I mean, in my simple view of economics is that the prices would have to start at least stabilising, if not coming down, because there would be more housing on the market.
Oh, we can't allow that, because the entire economy would start to look bad if the house prices start coming down. Anyway.
Well, it wouldn't, would it? Because it's Mickey Mouse money. I think anybody who thinks that, oh, my house is now worth 300,000 and I bought it for 200, I've made 100,000. We all know that it's Mickey Mouse money, monopoly money, because it's not real money, because if you've got to buy somewhere else, you're going to have to pay those inflated prices.
I mean, surely the economists up in London are saying, well, they're keeping a very close eye on house prices, because if house prices start to go down, then that's a very bad indicator for the rest of the economy.
Well, I did say stabilise. You know, if those units were built, and there's one that's very near me, and you ask why the builder hasn't built them, or the developer hasn't built them, because apparently they've all been sold off plan. Well, if I was one of those people who was waiting for those flats, I'd be very frustrated.
Anyway, Annie, your chance to talk about the homeless situation. I mean, we've heard clips there from, first of all, Anthony Palmer, who's an ex-forces single dad, desperate for somewhere to live, living in a place, as he told me there. And you can hear the rest of that interview, by the way, next week at midday here on BCFM on Dialect, where where with even with cockroaches in the place where he's presently living, and he's just taken over one of these houses that the council is trying to sell. He says it's perfectly good. Then also we heard from two mayor candidates, Paul Saville and George Ferguson, at the Pip and Jay's sleep out earlier in the year. So how are we going to fix this problem, and is it really the council's job anymore?
Well, it entirely is, and come back to the core issue here is the lack of social housing, which is what we need more of. We don't need more expensive flats, we need more flats and houses that are suitable for families and that are actually real affordable, not 80% of market value, because that's not affordable to anybody on a basic income. And the core problem here that no one's mentioned yet is right to buy, and it's under the sort of previous council administrations of Labour and Lib Dems, there were plenty of houses sold off under right to buy. There are increasingly amounts of housing association homes to be sold off under right to buy due to central Conservative government legislation. And that's what's really hurting us in Bristol. And that's what we need to, as a council, do everything we can to fight it, because that's what we're losing. We can't afford to lose anymore. And when we do sell houses under right to buy, we lose our income in a meaningful way to be able to build more. So not only do we lose that provision in the first place, we can't create any new provision. And that's what's really hurting us, and that's why we have a problem. And that's why when people get the brunt of the welfare cuts, they've got nowhere left to go, because we've had to have them all sold off due to central government legislation, and that's what we must face.
Alistair, I've got to ask you, put that point to you really, what's the logic behind the Conservative plan to sell off social housing with this right to buy?
It is a right to buy for those people who live within their house, and they've lived there, and they will continue to live there. I mean, it is a Conservative principle that we should hand a ladder to people to be able to improve their position in life and their family's position. And I think that if you were to speak to a lot of the people who have used right to buy, you will find that it's been absolutely brilliant for them. I mean, there is a lot of criticism over it, and I think that's because people don't actually understand how wonderful it's been to an awful lot of families. Now, the problem, and I think Annie is correct here, is that the money that was raised through right to buy hasn't been reinvested in more homes, and I think that's the real key to it. I actually think that it is good to offer people the right to buy, but we need to be building a home for everyone that is sold off.
Okay, I ought to also let Helen have a go on this, because Annie's brought it up, very important point. What's the logic behind it, Helen?
I absolutely have no idea, unless it's that the Conservative government want to see the end of social housing. And I think that we're very fearful about the impact of right to buy on housing association homes. And let's face it, when right to buy was brought in the 1980s, and I dispute slightly what Alistair said about how good everybody's found it, but councils weren't allowed to use the income for building new houses. Mm-hmm. They had to use it for paying off debt. And so it's made a bad situation worse. And people, certainly in the ward that I represent, I could take you to many people who actually regret that they bought their house, because they then found out maybe they lost their jobs, they couldn't afford the upkeep of the house. And whereas at one time you could drive around the estate or walk around the estate and see which houses had been where people had exercised the right to buy because they'd put a new porch on it or whatever. Sometimes
Pebble
now
dash.
You go round the estate, and the ones that are in the worst condition are the ones where they exercise the right to buy, because people haven't been able to afford it, or they've become disabled and they haven't been able to get into an accessible home. So I don't think it's been all the glowing story that it has, and actually people making a lot of money mm-hmm. out of being able to exercise the right to buy and get those discounts, They shouldn't have been able to have done that out of the public purse.
Okay. And the thing is, as well, it's getting on the housing ladder, but it's pulling the ladder up behind you, so that nobody behind you has even anywhere to live, let alone.
Okay, I ought to also say, I mean, we're hearing today from Labour Party, Helen Holland, the Green Party, Annie Stafford Townsend, and from the Conservatives, Alistair Watson. But I did also speak to and invite Michael Frost from the UK Independence Party and Gary Hopkins from the Liberal Democrats to be here today. Anyway, we've got another big referendum coming up soon. Folks, Brussels and the European Union. Is June's referendum Britain's most important vote for 40 years or not? And will you vote in or out, Alistair?
Yes, it is. It most certainly is. It will set the tone for many decades to come, regardless, you know, whichever way it votes. And it seems to be pretty well balanced at the moment, which is, it's quite an exciting referendum, I think, for everybody. I've come on a journey, actually, over the last few months. And if you'd have asked me 6 months ago, I think I would have said, on balance, I would be voting to leave the European Union. I've now decided that I would like to stay in. I think that the economic benefits outweigh the benefits of having our own sovereignty back and our border controls. So, funnily enough, I've
Alistair, I've the obvious thing to say that that is economically Britain has gone down the tube since the 1970s when we joined.
Yeah. Has it?
Yes. Yes, it has, yeah. I mean, if you just look at industrially
in the 1970s, you're probably not as old as me, Tony.
So was
but,
I, yeah.
But I was there. I was in employment in 1978 when this country was a basket case, I can tell you.
If you look at things like manufacturing and balance of payments and jobs, yeah. You know, full employment, all that's gone, isn't it? But anyway.
No. I mean, we are much more successful than we were back in the 1970s. Now, I mean, we've got higher standards of living. We've got, I mean, our employment rate is low. You know, we're not doing badly.
Okay, and for riding the crest of that wave.
Well, I'm on balance, and you know, I see the European Union as rather flawed.
Anyway, let's move on because we've only got a couple of minutes. Helen, what's your thoughts about this vote? Is it the most important vote for 40 years?
It's certainly very, very important. I think the thing that I really regret about that is that we seem to be having the referendum because, it was needed to hold the two sides of the Conservative Party together. And anyway, they're at each other's throats over it. Every night on the news we see this. So I regret that we're in the position where we've got to have the referendum. But I will certainly be voting to stay in, and I just hate to think about what this country will look like and what the consequences will be if we come out.
Annie, I know the Green Party, certainly in the 1980s, 1990s, was all vehemently against being part of the European Union, even saying that the MEPs that they sent were only there to bring about the exit of Britain from the EU. So what's your thoughts now?
That was the Green Party position a while back, but quite a long time now we've actually been very much a stay in camp. But under a reformed EU, it will be better for economic reasons, for environmental reasons, for human rights reasons, as well as peace on our soil reasons as well, and the lack of conflict that we've enjoyed.
Okay, just in the run-up to the Murdoch news at 6, Helen, what's your thoughts on this scrap today that's been going on in the Labour Party? Is the Labour Party got a problem with anti-Semitism?
Well, I'm really, really glad that they took the action against Ken Livingstone and Naz Shah yesterday that they did. I hope that there isn't an anti-Semitic problem in the Labour Party, because I feel like Andy Burnham said last night on Question Time, if there was, it wouldn't be an organisation that I was a member of. And I think the Labour Party should be proud of its role in promoting equal rights. And if there are those people, they need to be kicked out.
Okay. And we will be talking about that more in the second hour, because funnily enough, this 1933 agreement that Ken Livingstone appears to have been referring to, we were talking about on this show back in March. So thanks very much to our guests. There's Alistair Watson from the Conservative Party, Helen Holland from the Labour Party, and Annie Stafford Townsend from the Greens. We'll be back after the Murdoch news at 6.
For Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live.
from the Sky News Centre.